need to hide first. I'm going to take a moment. Let me cover myself in soap so nobody can see me.
Sounds like bullying.
Kind of.
Hearing these stories absolutely changed my life.
No, but for real. And I think in a lot of cases, like, legitimate concerns that people have where they're actually like, I am here in treatment because I want to recover. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely trying.
Hello. Welcome back to Eating Disorders Off Topic. This is Adam Pope alongside with Joe Nullenberg, and we are here with Sam and Marissa again. Lucky to have them back. Thank you again for joining us. We are going to be talking this time about terminal anorexia, the diagnosis, the ethics, morality, and everything to do with that and what it means. It's going to be an education for me, so please stick around, join us, and learn with me about what's going on with this controversial, I believe?
Very controversial, right? Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Yes, so excited to hear about it. I think we got some listener questions as well, kind of curious about what it means, so excited to jump into that. Sam, Marissa, would you like to introduce yourselves? I think, you know, our listeners will probably know you from the last couple episodes, but if you want to give us a quick introduction, who you are, what's your experience in this area?
Yeah, I can go. Marissa Adams, she, her pronouns. I'm intersex and have been involved with intersex advocacy for many years, and just within the last two-ish years become involved with kind of eating disorders as far as peer support, and then very recently kind of research and our interest in like research and writing manuscripts on eating disorder topics. And my first manuscript was actually in response to the terminal anorexia complicated, controversial topic. And yeah, lived experience of an eating disorder, and co-wrote the paper with a response with Sam. And I guess before we get into that, I'll let Sam go.
Thanks. My name is Sam. My pronouns are they, them. I am a intersex and transgender person, and I've been involved in trans advocacy for quite a while, and more recently got involved in intersex advocacy as well as doing peer support work around eating disorders, specifically in transgender and intersex populations. And I do have a academic science background, but interestingly enough, my first publication was also this paper on critiquing terminal anorexia that I was on with Marissa and a couple other collaborators. And I also identify as someone with living eating disorder experience, which has informed my work and perspective on this.
Thank you so much for being here. Yeah, Joy, I think you had some questions.
I was just going to say, so who would like to give a background to the yes. listeners on what is terminal anorexia, where did it come from, and why is it controversial?
I'm happy to go, and Sam, feel free to add anything. So terminal anorexia nervosa was actually proposed as a diagnostic phase in February 2022 by Dr. Jennifer Gaudiani and colleagues. She proposed this construct in the Journal of Eating Disorders, a very, very big, long publication. She provided three sort of case studies from her clinic as sort of evidence as what this presentation that she proposed is, and she outlined four criteria, which apparently in her author's opinion is terminal. And so those criteria is a diagnosis of anorexia nervosa, age 30 or older, prior persistent engagement in high quality multidisciplinary eating disorder care. And the fourth and final criteria is consistent, clear expression by an individual who possess decision-making capacity that they understand further treatment to be futile. They choose to stop trying to prolong their life, and they accept death will be the natural outcome. And then, of course, careful determination of decisional capacity is required. So those are the four criteria she outlined in her manuscript in the Journal of Eating Disorders. And then it was actually posted on her the social media, and that's actually how I first came into contact with it, scrolling through Instagram. Saw it and read the entire paper and was quite frankly horrified. And I don't think it's a problem for me to say that as someone with an eating disorder. It's not me, quote unquote, being triggered or overwhelmed. Like, it's a legitimate, distressing, problematic topic that I think clinicians and individuals with lived experience alike find problematic, especially the way the case studies were sort of presented as evidence for this construct and the manuscript. That's what I've got to say first about that, and Sam can jump in if they'd like.
Yeah, I think Marissa's done a great job providing an overview of the topic. Just something I wanted to add is that the way that this has been framed is that some people in the field have been arguing that we need to have staging for eating disorders and specifically anorexia. So the idea that after you've had anorexia for a while and not responded to what are, I guess, considered to be the first line treatments, then you should be considered to have something that's called severe enduring anorexia nervosa, or SEAD. And the presentation of this construct of terminal anorexia was kind of presented as, so a lot of people who have anorexia will respond to treatment and recover, but some people won't recover and they'll move into this sort of severe and enduring phase. And then some people in that phase will reach a point at which they can sort of accurately be considered to be terminal, and therefore the considerations around if and how they should be treated and how their desires to avoid suffering versus the belief by external parties that they can and should recover should be taken into account. And this paper that was published in February 2022 is not the first consideration of, like, can eating disorders be terminal, or how should we deal with, like, the potential that treatment becomes futile at a certain point in certain people's eating disorders. But it did uniquely propose these specific criteria and presents these specific cases to kind of support that criteria, even though, and I'm sure we'll get into it later, none of the cases, like, supported all of the criteria. And like Marissa, I also found the original article on Instagram. If I'm remembering correctly, I think I was literally, like, in a support group at the time, like, on Zoom, and not really paying attention and, like, looking at Instagram, and I saw the post from the clinic that said something like, individuals with terminal anorexia also deserve care and compassion. I was very confused about what that meant. And I found the paper, I saw that it was open access, and I, like, read the whole paper during the group, kind of half paying attention, but I was also kind of alarmed by some of the things that were mentioned in it, especially in terms of where I was at in my own experience. And, like, at that time undergoing what I later came to understand was, like, very traumatic and inappropriate treatment. So, yeah, I think that that's kind of...
That's a great summary.
Yeah, where I kind of came into being aware of this.
Yeah, and I'll share my introduction to it as well. I first saw the article and just saw the title about eating disorders and palliative care, and I was actually really excited about it because I think, in my mind, the idea of palliative care comes with the idea of meeting someone where they're at and meeting their needs as they define them, as opposed to, you know, just treating their disease as a disease. And so my initial reaction before reading the article was, oh, finally we're supporting people where they're at. And then I started reading the article and realized that's not it at all. So where do we start unpacking all of the controversy? Do you have a sense of like what the biggest disagreement stems from?
I think there's many disagreements from many different sides. I am not a clinician, but I have read every single paper that has been published by clinicians on in response to it. And generally, if I could just provide a quick summary of what I've perceived as their critiques, is that anorexia is treatable. It's just inherently not terminal, because terminal illnesses kind of inevitably sort of result in death, and anorexia is fundamentally medically different in that sense, and that essentially there is a quote-unquote medical cure, which is basically just sort of eating and medical care in that sense. So that has been one sort of argument or response from some of the other clinician papers.
Is the argument sort of that if someone dies of anorexia, they're dying from medical complications, not necessarily the anorexia, if that makes sense?
Right, like, yeah. Generally, everyone, I mean, people who die from anorexia are generally dying of medical complications and suicide. There are many instances where individuals with anorexia and other eating disorders commit suicide. But so in addition to kind of the clinicians, other doctors being like, this isn't terminal because the medical complications are mostly reversible, et cetera. And then otherwise kind of just like it's fundamentally wrong to sort of quote unquote allow someone to die, sort of essentially just forego all treatment, all medical care, and just die under the doctor's watch is, and I'm saying this very bluntly because this is, I'm just a very blunt person, but that's kind of my perception. And kind of the last sort of idea that I've picked up on from the doctor responses or other clinician responses is that individuals with anorexia sort of fundamentally have impaired decisional capacity, not in the sense of like their entire decisional capacity is impaired, but it's like the specific impairment to make the decision to decline treatment, decline medical care is sort of uniquely the only or typically the only aspect of mental decision-making capacity which is impaired in anorexia. So that is my kind of what I've gathered from the clinician sort of responses to this. The papers are Guarda et al., Brittle et al., so-and-so. I'm sure we could share those eventually if you need them. And then, of course, there's been a lot of people with lived experience, including our paper, that have responded with their own separate and sometimes similar critiques. But, of course, people with lived experience like myself have more kind of unique insight into this than other sort of doctors can provide in their responses. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any sense to like what was like maybe like the medical like catalyst or like what was going on in the treatment world or in the clinics that this came about as something they would want to like describe a name? You said there was kind of a, you know, they want to name different like areas, like different you know, if you've been having an eating disorder for 5 years, you're in this step. If you've been having one for 10 years, then we're just going to put you in like this, this area of, eating disorder treatment. Was there a sense of that led to like, hey, we should just call this what it is, or just like,
you know,
I don't know, like,
I had a,
was things not the way it should be?
Yeah. And this is just me not knowing what was in the minds of the people who wrote it. But as I was reading the article, I almost got the impression that it was people saying our treatment failed. How do we make it so that we can justify continuing to see these patients, even though we know our treatment isn't going to work for them? But that's just my gut response. That's not necessarily fact.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. I was trying to say that in a different way.
Yeah. It's kind of like,
I was thinking the exact same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, if our treatment can't save you, you're choosing to die.
We don't want to get sued. So we're going to make this up.
Yeah. Instead of actually having the self-awareness to say, is our treatment the right approach? Like, are there other options? It's like our treatment or death, which is frustrating.
Yeah, suffering or death is what it seems like. Either you fully recover or you're intractably suffering and you die. That's, yeah.
And like immediately what jumps into my mind, just having worked with many, many people over the years with eating disorders, the people that are jumping into my mind right now, I've known several people who suffered with anorexia for many, many years and went through many, many treatments and did not make significant clinical improvements. But what I also observed of these people is that they made major improvements in their eating disorder when they finally got away from situations where they were actively being abused or actively being silenced or actively in danger, that they were using their eating disorder to shield themselves from.
Yes.
And so like immediately what jumps into my mind is like, all of these, well, and I'm speaking just specifically of these case studies. I know there's many other presentations of eating disorders, and I don't want to discount that. But in my mind, these people who were being abused had been in a scenario where they did not feel that they could share it with anyone. And their treatment team was very authoritarian, very like, this is what we're doing. If you don't agree, it's because your brain is broken and there's nothing you can do about it. And just sit back and let us tell you what to do. And so they just sort of dissociated their way through treatment and were like, nobody's listening to me. Nobody cares. And so like, I don't know. For me, it's just so frustrating because if the treatment program had actually in the first place actually created a safe and trusting environment where the people had felt safe enough to disclose what was going on, perhaps they could have had a different result, but instead they just became more of the sort of oppressive authoritarian systems that they were trying to self-medicate from to begin with. And like I said, that does not cover everybody with an eating disorder, but the people who jumped into my mind are along that category.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it's interesting because one of the differences that I've seen between like a major theme and the clinical responses that disagree with this construct versus the lived experience perspectives disagreeing with this construct is for people with lived experience, there's less focus on like, well, eating disorders are always treatable and more on like, if we're considering somebody to have reached a stage where they don't respond to treatment, was the treatment that they received before any good, or did it completely miss the point, or did it even create more problems? Because something that's like really was really confusing to me, and I think I have a somewhat better understanding of it now, is that for anybody who spent time around other people with eating disorders in kind of a community or like lived experience space or discussion, the discussions about harm in and from treatment, which the fancy word for that is iatrogenesis, like that's ubiquitous. Everybody either has experienced themselves or knows somebody else who's experienced it. And it's kind of a given that like sometimes treatment is amazing and life-saving. Sometimes treatment is horrible. Sometimes it's kind of both at once. But there's so little documentation of that phenomena of treatment being harmful, of treatment like not responding to somebody appropriately, of treatment making issues worse. In the literature, especially out of the US, like there's a little bit of it out of like the UK and Australia, which I think might be because those are like nationally funded rather than private medical care systems. But absolutely. It seems like, yeah, like.
And I think part of what is making me uncomfortable that I think I haven't voiced out loud too is I feel like the people most openly promoting this particular definition of terminal anorexia are also people who work for the care systems who are known for being revolving doors and essentially producing dependent lifers. Like, these are the care systems where the moment someone walks in the door, they're told that they cannot trust themselves, that they do not have the capacity to help themselves. And they are taught to obey the system, to follow orders, to listen to their doctors. And so to me, it's no surprise that then when someone gets removed from, or, you know, leaves treatment and they've been told that they don't have the capacity to care for themselves, they don't have the capacity to advocate for themselves, they haven't learned any additional skills there. They've been taught that they have to let the doctors tell them what to do. And so I've actually known many people who have been to these treatment centers who, as soon as they start struggling, they realize that the way to get support is to, you know, increase your eating disorder symptoms. So there's people who will actively, intentionally try to get worse with their eating disorder because they need to go back for more care. And they're not given any other option to get tools to help themselves other than go back to treatment and get a new meal plan. And yeah, that's a whole other rant, but.
Yeah, I think that's a great point because it seems like, in my experience and the experience of a lot of other people, is as soon as like you reach out for care and disclose that you're struggling, in some cases it will just be like, well, you need to immediately go to a, you know, residential program or something. And that's kind of seen as the first and best option, as opposed to, okay, let's, you know, try and support you more in the context of your own life and not like make you stop working, stop being with your family, stop going to school or whatever, and then just go into an environment where you are your eating disorder and that's the only thing you think about. And it seems like, in addition to being inaccessible for so many people, that system can either have the outcome of people who, like, you know, are seen as non-compliant because they don't follow all of the rules in that very controlled, very institutionalized situation, or people who end up finding like their only source of comfort and stability in that system and those contexts. And then when they are put back into the context of their lives, they are not equipped to handle that. And so they feel like, okay, well, I did great at treatment, but, you know, I can't handle life. Or people who are seen as failing treatment because they get kicked out. And either way, like, it's ultimately failing those people, either because they are not able to get care because they can't tolerate this very difficult environment in which they're told is the only place that care can occur, or they are so conditioned to that environment that they can't stay out of it. And looking at the quote-unquote outcome of either of those as a failure that would then determine that somebody would be able to fairly conclude that future treatment is futile, I think is really inaccurate and is kind of overlooking a lot of really key factors.
Absolutely, 100%. Although it may unintentionally be accurate to say that future treatment of the same sort might be futile.
Yeah.
You know, because that might have been the case to begin with. And I think this would, can we talk about the irony here of like eating disorders are sort of known as, you know, people with eating disorders are prone to all or nothing thinking, like black and white thinking, like it's either this way or it's that way and there's no in between. And for treatment programs to essentially turn into black versus white, it's this way or that way. You know, you're going to live or you're going to die. You're going to follow us or you're going to die. You know, like there's some irony there.
There's, absolutely. Yeah, that's very accurate. Like, I know in kind of the higher levels of care I was at previously, it was like you follow the rules and there's like one, two strikes and then you're not following the rules. Well, sorry, we're discharging you administratively because you're not actively invested in following the rules. So that's
non-compliant.
That's one big example. And then of course also in the Gaudiani paper, it was kind of like you reach full recovery or you do a little bit of harm reduction, and if that doesn't work, well, you're terminal. And I think that is a big disservice because, I mean, in the eating disorder field as a whole, really struggles with even defining what recovery is other than DSM-5 remission. And if someone was presented with recovery as something that particularly would work for them rather than sort of, all right, we've tried everything. You've been to 5 different residentials, which is not very common. And then it's like, you've tried this, you've tried that. Well, everything's futile, et cetera. It's like when people who are so used to being in the system, and what I mean by that is sort of in and out of the treatment cycle, it's like recovery is presented in a very cemented, very one strict way. And if you're a person with an eating disorder, you may think, oh, since I'm not doing this, I'm relapsing. Like it's very,
yeah. And it's like, very black and white. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then when you have a provider who, you know, tells you that things are futile and, you know, little chance, like presenting harm reduction as sort of a last resort, like it's very much the eating disorder field being black and white.
Absolutely.
That's a really good point. I can't recall how many times just kind of like flirting with maybe this is it. Like, maybe this is just how things are going to be, you know, in treatment, and having that like thought of, yeah, I guess this is, you know, this is maybe it, or just, you know, and that thought being echoed by other people as well, you know, like getting so stuck in that process, or having done, you know, so much damage to your body, just thinking like, yeah, maybe there isn't, you know, this diagnosis sounds like me, you know, like, are there thoughts of like individuals with lived experience that have come up and said, yes, this sounds familiar, like I can get behind this, or has it been mainly treatment centers and physicians?
I think the people that I've heard who have actually gotten behind it have not gotten behind it because they agree with the definition. What they have gotten behind is the idea that finally they might get treatment where someone's meeting them where they're at.
Yeah, kind of that palliative care idea, mm-hmm. that you talked about earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that kind of leads also into the discussion, not to get too far off topic, but like the severe and enduring eating disorders. Just anecdotally, there's also different reactions to that. Like people who are labeled as severe and eating, you know, enduring eating disorders. On the one hand, it's like, it can be demoralizing where they're like, I'm labeled essentially a lost cause, and they kind of give up. But at the same time, they experience, or the experience from the people I've spoken to, I can't speak for everyone, is that their experience in treatment improves because finally they have a treatment program that will recognize that we're not just doing black and white thinking anymore. We're figuring out where you're at and trying to, you know, do harm reduction, trying to give you goals that you can maintain outside of treatment. Yeah. I think this whole conversation can kind of like, a lot of it boils down to, let's stop with the black and white thinking.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. And sometimes it's like really fascinating because there is black and white thinking that's kind of being built on a very sort of not only gray, but also unstable foundation, in terms of like, we don't have there is not a consensus definition for severe and enduring eating disorders or severe and enduring anorexia nervosa. Like when you look at what's published on it, different people use different definitions, and it can be, you know, like minimum of 3 years to minimum of 10 years of having an eating disorder before somebody would be considered to have that. And like, because so many people are not able to get treatment for a long time, either because they're not disclosing that they have an eating disorder or because they have some factor about them, like not being at a low weight or being part of a demographic not generally associated with having eating disorders, or because they cannot afford or cannot access healthcare. Like, it's not, I would say it's very not uncommon for somebody to have already had an eating disorder for at least 3 years, if not many more, before they even start getting treatment. So thinking about, like, when is a logical place to consider this to be a differentiated stage? Is it when somebody gets diagnosed? Is it when symptoms started? Is it when they start treatment? And in some cases, other factors are considered in this, like being at a low weight or having medical complications or having quote unquote failed treatment, but there's also not consensus about those things. And it just kind of seems like in some cases, people are saying over and over again, well, we need to improve these criteria. And sometimes I feel like it's less important to have better ways to categorize things than to just improve the overall level of like accessibility and care and autonomy in care, as opposed to being like, well, we need to specially define this special group that will not be, subjected to these types of harm, as opposed to questioning like, why is anybody being subjected to these types of harms, or why is anybody considered to like be appropriate for care that is, not based on their own needs and goals and priorities and what they feel capable of doing, or trying to identify like what is their eating disorder doing in terms of serving a purpose or providing a coping skill in their life, and just assuming, and again, that like everybody has the same experience and will respond to the same one size fits all care, and the idea that you have to go through that type of care for however long and be however seen as treatment resistant or seen as not responsive before you can try something else like harm reduction. And it also feels like it's not true harm reduction if it's seen as like a last resort or only for people who are believed to be incapable of doing anything better. Like, that can be, foundational at any point in time, and it's not something that like you can add on to an existing treatment structure. It needs to be informing how you approach care and when you consider somebody like, to be failing or to be needing to be discharged because they're not, as Marissa said, like, following the rules of the program or doing what the doctors are telling them to do.
And I also worry, like, the people who, of course, who are writing this and the people making the definitions of quality care, high quality care, is 100% going to be colored by people thinking, well, this is how we do treatment, so of course it's high quality care. So I don't know what their problem is if it doesn't work. Like, I feel like there's a high likelihood that the people defining the care are not the people receiving it. They're the ones designing and selling it.
Oh, yeah.
And those opinions may differ.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that like we came across while we were doing our research is that it's very hard to find like studies on care, especially in the US, that is objective as opposed to specific treatment centers being like, well, we did a study on our program, and we think our program works because people left with different BMIs than they came in with.
Right. And I feel like, one good metric would be, how many of their former clients are in the groups on Facebook talking about being harmed by eating disorder treatment. And I would love to see that metric. But yeah. So here's a sort of different question. How do we feel about the fact that this is being proposed specifically for terminal anorexia as opposed to any other eating disorder being terminal?
We don't like it.
Yeah, no. I think it just, I mean, I'll just go briefly and I mean, yeah, we don't like it. I mean, people with all eating disorders can die. And it is just sort of carving out in certain individuals with anorexia as, again, futile, hopeless, therefore terminal. Like, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, there's even outside of eating disorders, there's mental illness that is chronic. And I mean, this it's a whole nother story, but yeah, it's pretty one-sided and pretty biased, honestly. And it just doesn't make sense to me.
So I was talking to my roommate the other day. I was like, yeah, so when I was reading the DSM the other night, and she was like, what? But if you actually read the DSM section about eating disorders, which I don't recommend anyone do, like the way that eating disorders are diagnosed and defined is really confusing because there's not objective criteria of like, this is what this eating disorder is, this is what this other eating disorder is. They're all defined relative to each other, and you can only get one diagnosis at a time. And effectively, that means that like anorexia nervosa is an eating disorder defined by weight. So it's a low weight eating disorder that's not ARFID. And bulimia nervosa is a non-low weight eating disorder with binging and purging behaviors. And so effectively differentiating whether somebody has anorexia nervosa versus bulimia nervosa, if their purging is based on weight, and defining if somebody has non-purging anorexia nervosa versus atypical anorexia nervosa is also based on weight. And if d you have different clinicians who are going to sort of make different subjective decisions for somebody who's on the cusp between those two things, then depending on which clinician a person happens to see will affect which diagnosis they get. And if somebody has the exact same types of behaviors, but their weight fluctuates over time, then their diagnosis might change over time. And there's one study that we came across where they were basically, for research purposes, having one nurse weigh and evaluate eating disorder patients one day, and the next day a different nurse would do it. I think it was nurses. And depending on like very minimal weight shifts during sleep, patients in a non-negligible percentage of cases were given different diagnoses. So the fact that like we would consider anorexia nervosa to have this unique potential for a terminal stage, but another eating disorder that isn't necessarily all that different besides minor weight differences to not have that really is inconsistent. And another issue that I had with the original paper proposing this criteria for the so-called terminal anorexia was that it argued that we can only propose this for anorexia nervosa because it's the only eating disorder that can cause death that is known to occur within 6 months if treatment ceases. But then
So they're
when it
just
gets in,
not counting suicide?
yeah, so they're not really counting suicide. They're only counting medical deaths in that cases. But then when they're going through the case studies and they're going through the rest of the paper, they specifically say like, we're not going to outline specific types of like medical risk or medical complications that would make somebody eligible versus ineligible for this criteria, because if they're suffering a lot, then they shouldn't have to like display extreme medical instability. And people with any type of eating disorder at any weight can be suffering enormously. And people with any eating disorder at any weight can experience really severe medical complications, including death. And I don't think that there's like adequate evidence to prove that death can be predictable on the time scale that was stated for even low weight anorexia nervosa. Like, death can definitely
Absolutely.
occur, but it's often more stochastic than we think it is. So I think
Right.
those
Well,
are
then.
some of the many reasons why, like, considering this to be a unique potentiality with only anorexia is problematic.
Absolutely. And I'm just reflecting on people that I've known who have passed from their eating disorders. And I think a lot of them were actually normal weight people with bulimia who died of electrolyte imbalance, like acute electrolyte imbalance, even though, you know. And so like I don't know. I don't I still yeah, I would love to see the data on and you know, just going back to what you said too about the categories, I know prior to the DSM-5 work group, we did a lot of research on that subject and gave, you know, weighed in and gave our perspectives. And I vividly remember, you know, going through research studies that had looked at, you know, anorexia, binge purge type versus, you know, bulimia, and found essentially no difference whatsoever other than the weight. And that, you know, the weight was just a nonsense criteria. Yeah, and we could talk about that forever. I think the there's a sort of elephant in the room for me too whenever we talk about anorexia, and a lot of it comes down to there's a specific type of treatment modality that depends on like it's a critical point in their viewpoint to say that we need to force care on people with eating disorders because their brains are malnourished, and that is why they're acting as they're acting. And so I think a lot of other eating disorders get ignored because and we tend to see this a lot, like in the parent community, in the, you know, revolving door treatment center community, where we don't want to listen to patients. We want to be able to say their brains are broken, we can't listen to them, we will give them a meal plan and then they'll be all better. And I think the people who are at different weights, the people who have different behaviors, the people who have, you know, different nutritional status, it sort of interferes with that belief and their entire conceptualization of what an eating disorder is. And I think that is its own problem.
Yeah, definitely. I think, like, we know that people with any eating disorder, any weight, may be malnourished. And that's not something you can tell by looking at somebody. And even if somebody is experiencing differences in cognition or increased rigidity or cognitive distortions because of being malnourished, that doesn't mean that they don't deserve compassion, that they don't have a sense of self and a sense of what they will experience as, you know, more or less traumatic. And sometimes I think that it can be really difficult to determine, like, what is the best thing for a person, but just categorically deciding that somebody should get no input in their treatment because of that perceived deficit is really harmful.
Absolutely. And it's there's a huge risk factor, and we've seen it, you know, just knowing people who have come through different treatment programs, there's a huge risk factor for traumatizing patients when you have, you know, taken away their right to, you know, dissent to anything, not gotten consent from them, and you've given yourself the right to do whatever you want to their body, no matter how much they protest. And I think that's a very slippery slope. And I think one of the critical things for safety in that situation is to preserve the patient's right to essentially have veto power. You know, if they say, like, you know, yes, I know treatment's going to be uncomfortable, but, like, this is a whole different kind of uncomfortable, and I, you know, I need to safe word out of this, you know. But if you've convinced yourself that an eating disordered person can't think clearly, like, that's dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely not inherently, like, all people with anorexia can't make the decision. I think, again, there are some individualized discrepancies, but I don't think blanketly it's anorexia. People with anorexia have impaired decision making, or inherently, they do have, you know, the full and complete right, because they have, like, again, it's just more black and white within the eating disorder community. And you pointed out something great, that this often isn't talked about in other eating disorders. Like, Sam mentioned all the overlapping criteria and how a lot of it is, you know, just essentially just differentiated between weight, even bulimia and binge eating disorder. It's differentiated by one behavior, which is, I guess, purging. You don't hear about decisional making capacity in bulimia and other eating disorders. It's all anorexia. And I think this has given the opportunity and facilitated the founding of terminal anorexia, with just how differentiated anorexia has been from other eating disorders for so long.
Yeah. And it's interesting how it switches, isn't it? Where, you know, in treatment, the treatment programs say, you know, you just need to sit back and listen to us because you're not capable of making decisions for yourself. But then somehow in the definition for terminal anorexia, there's the assumption that the patient will be able to advocate for themselves or, you know, make sound decisions. And it's like, when does that switch happen? You know, it's like, you can't have both things be true at once. Like, either
someone apparently it happens when someone turns 30.
Okay. Yeah. Good to know.
Based on the criteria.
Yeah. Yeah.
They put a number on it. Yep.
Yeah. So that is fascinating.
So with a terminal diagnosis, is this something that, like, just that they think doesn't leave, or, you know, like Joy mentioned, is it one of those things where, like,
if you're diagnosed with terminal anorexia, and you know, as many of us have, go over to bulimia for another diagnosis and be like, it's okay, I'm not terminal anymore, I just have bulimia. Is that
That's a great
like,
question.
right? Like, did you
Wait,
just go back and forth? It's like, it wasn't terminal, I've just got bulimia now.
that is a really good question, and yeah, I'll just touch on the one point that, like, again, like eating disorders, there's even eating disorder treatment says like symptom fluctuation or symptom substitution, whatever, and there's diagnosis fluctuation. I had two separate diagnoses, ED diagnoses. So again, like if someone has 2 years of one eating disorder, another whatever years of another, like does that mean they've had consecutive years? Like who knows? No, it's so just like ambiguous. And then again, with the Gaudiani paper, I think it is acknowledged that even with terminal anorexia, someone can decide to re-engage with treatment, etc.
Well,
But if they're deemed terminal and they,
my head,
I know my head
right?
is
My
exploding.
head hurts.
Like, yeah, if I'm terminal
You can
in
just behave
remission, like, who
yourself out
knows?
of terminal illness.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And that's like one of the things that I think a lot of people have been trying to grapple with, and it's difficult to make a cohesive argument about it because everything just feels so slippery. Because when you're thinking about the way that like terminality is defined in other illnesses, it means that your biological illness has been proven to not respond to any available treatments.
Yes.
But given the kind of complexity of a person's relationship to an eating disorder, when the thing that's not responding to treatment is not entirely, but is not completely divorced from like choice and motivation. Like I want to be very careful about this because I don't think we can say eating disorders are choices in a black and white way, but I also don't think we can say that choice, motivation, and context plays no role in recovery. And we know that it's very common for there to be ambivalence and fluctuations, and in some cases, like unbelievable and dramatic fluctuations in people's relationship to recovery or even relationship to life throughout the course of their eating disorder. And the thing that can make the difference between being completely unwilling to give up the eating disorder and really wanting to recover and really wanting to live, or even just wanting to like manage the symptoms enough to live, can be really random sometimes. And it's not necessarily going to come from a treatment program. It might be just like waking up one day and being tired of it, or finding something else in your life that's more interesting, or like having a niece or nephew be born. And it's very hard to predict what that is in the way that we can more accurately predict if somebody, again, has a medical illness that's not responding to all available treatments. And there's been some, like, I think very valid concerns being expressed, especially in like national healthcare systems. Like, if somebody is considered to be terminal and then kind of put on like a hospice care pathway as a result of that, like would they be able to ever get recovery focused care again when there is such a scarcity of resources? If they're seen as like, well, if you've already been
Yes.
diagnosed as terminal, then you have a low likelihood of responding to this, and you're not going to get access to those resources if we think you're a greater liability than somebody else.
That's a great point. Yeah. Well, and it's also interesting too that the switch isn't okay. So like terminal illness is usually based on biological status, right? But the terminal status is more based on are they engaging with treatment, which those two things are not one and the same. And I know, I mean, we've probably all known many people with eating disorders, because they do exist, who are very ill for many years and they live decades. So like if someone leaves treatment and they're terminal and then they live for another 30 years, like is that really useful? Like do they just go to hospice for a few decades, or
Yeah.
like death isn't necessarily like imminent in all cases.
Yeah, and I think the response to that from the original paper on this is that somebody shouldn't have to live in a state of extreme physical and psychological suffering caused by their eating disorder, if they are indeed to live for a prolonged amount of time, like they should have the option for not doing that, which is what led into the issue that we didn't really discuss, but that the authors of the original papers did discuss about medical aid in dying. And I don't super want to get into that in detail because I think that that is kind of another topic, but I think I do think it's relevant to these ideas about like is, you know, life with a severe eating disorder that's not responsive to available treatments like a form of suffering that's so great that people shouldn't have to endure it. And if we decide that's true, at what point does the suffering that's caused by an eating disorder or that's caused by having been through harmful and traumatic treatments like so great that it should be considered unendurable? And why are we only reserving the recognition of that suffering from this like very select population of people who have a specific diagnosis and a specific physical presentation?
Absolutely. And if we're acknowledging that care, you know, and treatment can be harmful and, you know, not fun, like, can we actually start holding treatment centers accountable for inflicting harm? That's a whole other question. Yeah.
Yeah, like the idea that any amount of suffering in a treatment setting is worthwhile if somebody is seen as like still able to have a good outcome from it. But when we've decided that somebody isn't eligible or will not likely have a good outcome, then it becomes unacceptable, which is like confusing to me.
Absolutely. I think it all still like keeps coming back to the concept for me that maybe if we cared about people's lived experience from the start of treatment, like, you know, maybe people would actually be getting competent care. People wouldn't be harmed by care. People would get treatment sooner and not have to suffer for so long. You know, it's just frustrating to me that like it's not until we've decided that someone is prepared to die that the treatment community is suddenly like, oh, let's meet them where they're at. And that just, I don't know. This whole topic just kind of like highlights that for me, that discrepancy of that not happening in early treatment.
Yeah, it's very mind-blowing. And another thing that I think really contributes to iatrogenic harm and not, I hope I'm saying that right, and kind of not providing people with what they really need to succeed is, you know, especially in the US, most of the basically like experts who know a lot about eating disorders are working in these higher levels of care. And then sort of again, like when the higher level of care bubble pops and you're back into your regular world, there are like very, very few specialized eating disorder providers in the community not affiliated with treatment centers because all the people who like have the training work in these giant treatment centers. And there are, I guess, some specialized outpatient providers in the community, but they are few and far between and outrageously expensive.
Usually private pay. Yeah.
Right. Yep. And so again, I think that's touching on what you said earlier. And I mean, this is absolutely true for me previously. I mean, the facilities I went to for treatment was 6 hours away from where I lived. And then I would get discharged and then go home and had no eating disorder support. And so then it was like, oh, well, I had become so reliant on it in a weird way that it was like the only way I can get support again and be around people who know how to treat eating disorders is by making myself more ill, therefore having to go back to treatment to even be around providers who know kind of what they're doing. And that,
Absolutely.
again, that's very one-sided and very, you know, not a good comparison to a lot of situations, but
Yeah, it
I
is a
think,
common experience, though.
yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I,
Where do we
oh, go ahead.
Where do we see this diagnosis, or, you know, if there's additional papers about this. Where do we see that kind of going as far as furthering dialogue about terminal anorexia? Like, is it going to be a more common in use in treatment centers, or, you know, is it kind of remaining on the outside, not really picking up fans?
I guess I don't work at a treatment center, so I can't really say how it's showing up there. It seems like from the, if you look at the papers that have been published on this topic in the last, I guess, 2 years now, I would say the majority of them have been vehemently opposed to this idea for various reasons. And it seems like there has been a lot of concern and pushback from both, providers and people with lived experience. There have been like a couple parents who will like respond to any tweet criticizing this idea, saying that, you know, they wish their child had had access to this, which is kind of interesting. So like there's definitely people who are being very supportive of it, but it doesn't seem to have taken hold necessarily in terms of becoming like part of how treatment is understood. But there are some things that have been very concerning. Like I've heard from people that they are seeing people like of all ages, like asking about this, like, hey, would this be a possibility for me to, you know, get this diagnosis and get access to like hospice care, because it sounds very enticing relative to like how
for sure
brutal and traumatic like traditional treatment can be. And there definitely have been sort of things that have, I don't think anything that's been like set in stone, but concerning like things that some people have witnessed in other countries that have these nationalized health services about like this would be sort of an alternate care pathway for people who are seen as failing treatment, and potentially in ways that would not be sort of based on a conversation with the patient. It would be sort of determined for them, which would be, you know, extremely concerning. And like something that I've witnessed is just how this whole discourse has affected people with lived experience who are either like feeling good about their recovery now, but just feel haunted by like, what if I had seen, you know, this doctor at this time and they would have told me I was terminal and that would have been very appealing to me at the time. But, you know, something has changed since then and now I'm doing better and I'm so grateful for my life. Or people who are feeling really conflicted about like, you know, still struggling and not knowing whether this is something that they would see as a better option or not, without having, you know, any opportunity to get non-traumatic treatment. Because that's like another thing that I won't go into too much because it's a whole another topic. But like when you think about people who've had long-term eating disorders, oftentimes they're not in a situation where they have excellent specialized care where they could have a holistic conversation about this. Oftentimes like they are being given ultimatums about going to like one program that's covered by Medicaid or having no treatment, or they, you know, have very little support from like any kind of medical professionals or family because everybody around them has just been exhausted by this experience and they don't have access to financial resources. And so it's sort of like they're not able to make a fully considered decision because there isn't, you know, time and support and the level of care that's said to be necessary for making this determination, but that, as Marissa mentioned, is generally not accessible to most people.
Absolutely. And I think I just want to, just for emphasis, highlight for the audience that it's not uncommon for people to, like, I feel like this just needs to be like reiterated, that people are actively seeking the terminal anorexia, you know, diagnosis, not necessarily because they have given up fighting against their eating disorder, but because it actually gives them an out to get away from harmful care. And I think that that's a whole other can of worms, but I just want to highlight that that's a thing.
And it can be a very potentially enticing label for people whose identity is so interlinked with anorexia or their eating disorder. Like, I mean, if severe and enduring eating disorder is one label, terminal is like potentially something even more to achieve for any, and again, these things are not considered by even the quote unquote experts who think they really understand the eating disorder, what it can do. I think it does present kind of an identity sort of based label. And then also, of course, just the sort of, well, I've tried everything, time to just take this easy out.
Absolutely.
So it's very dangerous in many reasons.
Yeah. And it is common, like there is a subset of people with eating disorders, and they're usually people who are sort of trapped in, you know, community or family dynamics that are very unhealthy, and they feel sort of trapped, and they kind of end up using coping tools that are unhealthy, but they're all they've got in that situation. And you know, there's some people who, like, their family won't listen to them or whatever, so they'll be like, well, I have an eating disorder, so I have like a pass from like what you're asking me to do, or you know what I mean, like there's the sort of unhealthy group dynamic that sort of forces people into, if I play the sick one, people will treat me differently, you know? And I think that kind of plays into like what Marissa is saying, where it's like, well, you can't say that to me because I'm dying, or you know what I mean? Like, and I say that very carefully because the people in those situations are like doing the best they can. And I don't know how else to describe that, but it happens.
Yeah, I think generally, oftentimes eating disorders are seen as something that like either has like a very kind of stereotypical cause, or that is just sort of seen as random to occur in somebody's life, as opposed to something that is serving, you know, a very specific purpose that emerges in a very specific context. And in some cases, like, it remains necessary because that context remains. And in other cases, the context goes away or changes, and the eating disorder morphs to adapt itself to the new context, or is just at that point habitual. But
absolutely,
I think that's often overlooked. And also just in terms of like the considering possibilities of like death and terminality, I think we don't talk enough about how eating disorders can be seen as like both something that keeps somebody alive when they don't have any other coping skills accessible, or something that allows someone to have what feels like a autonomous relationship with death, where they're like, you know, courting death in this direct or indirect way through their eating disorder. And sometimes it can be both at once for someone. Mm-hmm. And if we're overlooking that, I think we are like really problematically overlooking ways that this kind of construct could be really enticing for people for reasons other than the, you know, intended purpose of it. And
absolutely, I feel I feel like that could actually be, you know, for the people who are proposing the terminal anorexia, like if they are really going through with, you know, trying to make this happen, like I would recommend that the very first step before any of the terminal anorexia conversation comes into play is, have you actually taken the time to figure out if the eating disorder is protecting them from something else that's causing them harm? Because I don't think that happens enough, but I think that is a scenario that is not uncommon. I mean, and like I said, not everybody is using the eating disorder to protect them from harm, but it happens frequently enough that it should be just automatic to check in on that before you've decided that, well, we're just going to write them off.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like another question that we don't really have an answer to is like, what is the difference between somebody accepting like that treatment is futile and accepting that death will occur without future treatment versus somebody being suicidal? Especially since we know that suicidality is very common in eating disorders. And that's, I think, something that was really under-considered in the original papers, because...
Yeah, that's a great point.
But yeah, just how you would support somebody with those things is very important. And that's not to undermine any of them.
Very good point. So I think we're kind of ending or reaching the end of our session here. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that is something we want to make sure to get before the end of the episode?
I just have one thing, and I think it kind of touches on something you mentioned earlier, but I think, you know, hopelessness is a very, very common feeling in eating disorders of all types and state or stages, durations of illnesses. And I, one thing I would just mention is, you know, I never went to or left treatment being like, all right, I'm ready to give my eating disorder up. I'm ready to recover. I do say it was kind of more a spontaneous thing for me. And I think that is extremely underconsidered, especially in these terminal situations. Well, not a lot of terminal situations, but in this terminal paper, et cetera, in general, I mean, yeah, like people can leave treatment not cured, feeling cured, and still, you know, go on to recover whatever that is for them. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, even if there's people out there listening to this and you, you know, feel like treatment is, you're not going to get what you want from it or what you should get from it, like, there is hope. Again, I came across people in their 50s and 60s who got something out of it. And even if they didn't, quote unquote, fully recover, it was, they found enough stability. And sometimes life just falls into place. Sometimes it doesn't, but sometimes it does. And that entirely cannot just be ruled out.
Absolutely. You can always do one thing better, you know?
Yeah. You know, speaking on that point too, Marissa, about how, you know, leaving treatment and just being like, I guess I'm going on to try and find out what recovery means to me, you know? And as someone who's been through, you know, alcohol addiction treatment more times than eating disorder treatment, and ultimately it was just one weekend being sober now for 5 years. It was just kind of I didn't expect it, but wouldn't have known it, you know, going through treatment several times and relapsing and going back and forth. I feel like the road to recovery, you know, can be, you know, rocky and windy, and it can be a little dangerous to give that off path sometimes.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, we appreciate Marissa and Sam coming here and sharing their wisdom again. This has been really a really good conversation, I think. Adam, do you have anything to add?
No, not at all. I felt like I was just soaking in a lot. Just really absolutely appreciating their expertise and knowledge, and I feel like I thought of a question and I'm like, nope, they're just answering it now. So it was incredibly informative, and I'm sure our listeners will feel the same way too. So looking forward to, you know, including some links along with our, you know, our notes on the episode as well. So where can our listeners find you or find your work?
Well, I work with several different organizations. The one most applicable to this conversation is Fed Up Collective, but of course not, you know, speaking on behalf of them or anything today. I am happy to provide an email address for anyone, but generally, you know, I am with Fed Up Collective and happy to connect with anyone through there or just kind of on my own, and happy to provide an email if anyone's interested.
Yeah, I'm also part of Fed Up Collective and can be reached that way. And I also invite people to check out the paper that Marissa and I were authors on terminal anorexia, as with this topic as a whole. It's a very distressing subject matter, and I trust people to, know if that's something that's safe to engage with or not. But if you want to read it, the title, which I apologize for, has a lot of big words in it, which is mostly my fault, is Inaccessibility of Care and Inequitable Conceptions of Suffering, a Collective Response to the Construction of Quote Unquote Terminal Anorexia Nervosa. And it's published as an open access paper in the Journal of Eating Disorders, which means that you don't have to pay to read it. And Marissa and I are working on a couple other publications, which will hopefully be out soon. So, yeah, you can find some of our work there.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we'll definitely check back in, with updates later on and see how things are going. So, thank you very much for your time. Thanks again for our listeners sticking around with us for this extended, especially important episode. Thanks again for our audio producer, Brianne Dunn. And thank you for my co-host, Joy, and our guests again for being here. Thank you, listeners, for providing us with this platform as well. So have a great day and have a great year.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.